Good evening, everyone, and thank you all for coming to the Lowy Institute's celebration of the 40th anniversary of Papua New Guinea's independence. Before we begin the proceedings, I would like to acknowledge and pay respect to the traditional owners of the land on which we meet tonight, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respect to the elders both past and present. My name is Jenny Hayward-Jones. I'm the director of the Lowy Institute's Melanesia program. The program I run has a strong research focus on Papua New Guinea and on Australia's relations with our nearest neighbour and the wider Pacific Islands region. We also manage, for those who don't know, and with the support of the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, the Australia-Papua New Guinea Network, an initiative intended to deepen the people-to-people relations between Australia and PNG. And as part of that network, we run an annual Australia-PNG Emerging Leaders Dialogue, which builds connections between young Australians and young Papua New Guinean professionals and young leaders. It is under the auspices of the Australia PNG Network that we're able to host this event tonight. It is, in fact, the fourth major event we've convened this year on Papua New Guinea, and intentionally to celebrate the 40th anniversary. We've had such a great response each time, which gives me fantastic confidence that there's a lot of interest in expanding people-to-people relations in this very significant year. I think some of you might have been here for Prime Minister Peter O'Neill's lecture in May, and some of you also for our PNG roundtable in April, so welcome back. We were also in Brisbane last night for our first PNG-related event there and had a fantastic and engaged crowd at the Gallery of Modern Art to see both this panel and a concert by legendary PNG musician George Telec. Unfortunately, I was unable to bring George to Sydney, but he is playing in Sydney tomorrow night for anyone interested in seeing him. Tonight, we're really excited to be hosting this panel, a panel discussion on the future of Papua New Guinea with three important voices from the next generation of leaders. In a moment, I'll introduce our moderator, Sean Dorney, who will then introduce our three panellists for our discussion. We'll have about 40 minutes of discussion between Sean and the panellists and then open the floor to questions from you. We'll aim to conclude by 7 and then we're serving drinks and some canapes, so please stay on and have a chat with each other and with our panellists. And finally, can I ask you all to switch your mobile phones to silent? Sean Dorney is a non-resident fellow with the Lowy Institute. After reporting on the Pacific for the ABC, with a particular focus on Papua New Guinea for over 4 decades, Sean left the ABC in August last year. During his time there, he won a Walkley Award for his coverage of the Aitape tsunami and was both deported and awarded an MBE by the Papua New Guinea government. He is the author of Papua New Guinea, People, Politics and History since 1975 and The Sandine Affair, Politics and Mercenaries in the Bougainville Crisis. Over to you, Sean.
Thank you very much, Jenny. Good evening, and anyone who doesn't recognise me because I'm wearing a suit, this is the second time in 2 days that I've actually put a suit on, and I'm finding the tie rather constricting. But I'd welcome you all to this special event here at Lowy, marking the 40th anniversary, which is coming up next week, just 5 days away now. And you can see from the rather youthful look of the panel here that I'm the only one probably with vivid memories of the 16th of September 1975. I remember at the flag-raising ceremony, Imelda Marcos, the wife of the President of the Philippines, turned up fashionably late, much to the annoyance of some of the media, but not to the annoyance of most of the people there who welcomed the day, and there was a lot of very good feelings around Papua New Guinea on that particular day in 1975. Independence had come peacefully and there was a lot of goodwill. One of the people there didn't last much longer. It was Gough Whitlam, who was there for Papua New Guinea's independence celebrations and then was removed by Sir John Kerr within a few months. And the story is told that Michael Somare, on hearing this news, said, "Oh, well, look at that. We've just let them go, and look, they're already in a constitutional mess." 1975, for me, was incredibly important for one other reason. It was the year I was selected for and played for the Papua New Guinea National Rugby League team, the Kumuls. And I said last night that my son, Xavier, showed my grandson, Eli, who's only 4, a photo of the Kumuls team. And Eli, being very perceptive, said, why is Grandpa wearing a wig? Actually, in another game I played the next year, 1976, I was the captain of the Kummels, and I scored one try. We actually played a country New South Wales representative team, and we won the game, and I scored a try, but I also gave one away. I threw a pass, and one of their wingers intercepted it and raced sort of 50 metres to score under the posts, and there was this yell from the crowd saying, "He's just helping his one-talks." Now, Graham Dobell's put a very positive spin on this. Graham Dobell said that the person said, "Leave Sean alone, he's just helping his one-talks." Whereas I think it was more like, "That bloody white bastard, why was he picked? He's just helping his one-talks." Anyway, tonight, with the help of my three panellists, we'll be looking not so much at the past as towards the future and the likely challenges facing Papua New Guinea now that it is 40 years independent. So let me introduce the three of them very briefly. Sarina Suminop is a lawyer by profession. She's just completed a Master's of Business Administration at the Queensland University of Technology and is the founder and executive director of The Voice, Inc., which is a PNG youth development organisation. Geoffrey Feger is one of PNG's most acclaimed artists, whose show, he appeared in a show called Feather that was a hit at the 2013 New York Musical Theatre Festival. And Alan Bird is an agricultural expert who used to be known as the Vanilla King in PNG, and he now hosts a Q&A television program in PNG called Tanim Ground, which is Tanim Ground, tilling the ground. I'm going to ask each of the panellists to provide a bit of a better introduction to themselves than I've just given you by briefly telling us a little bit more about how they've succeeded and what they hope to be able to contribute to PNG's future. And I'll start with Alan. Alan, can you tell us about how you went from village to village trying to encourage Papua New Guineans to use those agricultural skills to earn money?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Sean. And I think every Papua New Guinean, we belong somewhere, to a specific place. And growing up in that environment amongst, you know, within a clan or a tribe, you're always interested in how you can help. And I think it's expected also that you should help those that are in your tribe and so on. Some years ago, my grandfather passed away in 93, and I was working in Noctedi at the time, and I flew home for the burial. It took 18 hours to travel the 300-kilometer road, and by the time I got home, they'd already buried my grandfather. And at the time, my village had a bit of a nasty reputation for being the hold-up kings of the Sipik. And it was something that I wasn't very pleased with, the fact that my people were only good at holding up other Sipiks and robbing them of their money and helping themselves to the rest of their belongings and so on. So I remember chatting with my cousin at the time and, you know, going back a bit. I grew up in the settlements of Medang. I don't know, I guess you could say the slums of Medang. And I grew up amongst a lot of young men who were on the other side of life, you know. And I was always interested in you know, the gifts that I have. You know, I'm pretty smart, and, you know, how can I help them do better and, you know, maybe find jobs and help their families? So I kind of applied that back home. I was talking to my cousin at the time, who was one of the criminal gang leaders at home, and I said to him, "Why do you rob all these people? You know, why do you do it?" And he said to me, "Oh, look, Alan, if you go to the garden, we've got heaps of food and, you know, like taro and bananas and all those sorts of things, but when your nephew and your nieces cry to me and say they want soft drinks and they want twisties and all those sorts of things, I don't have the cash to buy that. So I have to take it from other people." So I thought to myself, well, why don't we try changing that? And so we had a discussion in the village. We were all sitting around a fire. There was hardly any light, no electrical light. And at one point, we even considered growing marijuana and you know, sending it down here so we could make a buck. And even though we were on the other side of the country, I'm sure the logistics, we could have figured it out. But in the end, we settled on vanilla. At the time, the going price was around $15 a kilo. And I thought, wow, okay, we could do this. And interestingly enough, the Australian Colonial Administration, they had a research station at Beinick up in Maprik for all sorts of crops. And they'd done some trials on vanilla. My grandfather and some of his contemporaries went and pinched the vanilla vines because they resemble the orchids species that they used. I'm an abalam, so we're known for growing these massive yams for village competitions. And they thought the vine that the white man brought would make the yams grow even bigger. Anyhow, by the time we 40 years later, 30 years later, when we found these vines, they were up in quila trees, and we just pulled them down, and we started planting. We got lucky. Later on, with the problems in Madagascar, and prices went through the roof. And I think at the time, it was a little bit of a blessing for Papua New Guinea. Our currency was sitting at around 18 US cents, and Papua New Guinea didn't have a lot of money. And I remember within a three-year period, I think we made about 3 or 4 billion kina. And it was the first time Papua New Guinea produced 10%, more than 10% of the world's anything. So I was quite proud of that. And, you know, I had to go from village to village and teach people how to do it properly, because one of the things they did was that when they thought we had something good, they started stealing the vines again. So, you know, this process of stealing and planting went on. And the rest is history. The good thing with that is that some 15 years later, well, 20 years later almost, as a result of all of that, from my village particularly, at one point there were only two people that had gone to university, which was myself and my uncle. And my sister, sorry. But today, over 10 people from my village have actually gone to university and other villages in the area as a result of people being able to make money and, purchasing things like solar panels, getting electricity, even being able to afford to send their sons and daughters away to other educational institutions and so on and so forth. So I think we've done pretty good.
Excellent. Serena, can you tell us about The Voice, how you established it and what it does?
Thank you, Sean. So I think firstly I'd just start by saying it was a real pleasure to be able to talk to a couple of people in the room that came and introduced themselves to me as being teachers of my father-in-law. And I think that really, for me, really began to reinforce, I guess, the reason why I do what I do. Because I think we're, as a country, at the threshold of seeing the children of independence that had grown up at that time when the country had first received independence, and they had a lot of hopes and dreams for how the country would grow and would run and their place of contribution in it. And now we see 40 years, almost 40 years later, 5 days, their children also looking, you know, at that same landscape going, you know, where's my place of contribution and what can I give? I was very privileged to have grown up in a home where my father, one of the first in his area to get educated, get a degree, a hardworking public servant, and I live in that legacy that he was able to give to us, a good education. A lot of my formative years were spent overseas. He was a diplomat. I remember returning back, I think when I was about 13 years old, and again, just being confronted with, the stark difference, you know, between PNG. And I always remembered thinking back then, even as a 13-year-old, like, wow, there's so much that we can do here in this country. And I think a lot of that played into what I am doing now with young people, hopefully trying to expose them to, you know, better ways of living, other strong role models, you know, and the importance of valuing the things that are important right now. I also remember coming back, and again, when you are overseas, you are Papua New Guinean and you're proud of it. Everyone is, you don't ask, you know, which province are you from, this and that. Everyone's just really proud to be Papua New Guinean. And I remember coming back, and just as it is, you know, any teenager anyway, find it really hard to fit in when you go into a new environment. But with me, I had the added pressure of not really being able to speak Pidgin. For some reason, my father didn't allow us to speak Pidgin in the house. It was either language or English. Don't speak Pidgin. The other thing, you know, betel nut was not something we were allowed to chew at all. Otherwise, you got threatened with school fees being cut off from you. And if you knew you didn't make it and you didn't do well in school, that's okay, because the village was there and our aunties and uncles were very well and capable of looking after us. So those were some of the key things that I remember growing up with. And it was different from other kids in school, and a lot of that affected my self-esteem. But I think I always knew that I could contribute, and I wanted to contribute. But when you're not confident, you find it hard to find your place. And I always tell this story. Like, I remember when I'd be in grade 7 or 8, and I'd sit in the classroom, and it was time to vote a class captain, not a school captain, a class captain. And I'd have sweaty palms. I'd be sweating because I'd have this, like, voice inside of me saying, like, Serena, you know, you're a leader. You can contribute. I'd be like, no, I can't. I can't even raise my hand and answer a question when I know the answer. And I'd have this inner battle going on inside my head. Of course, no one knew that I was going through that at the back of the classroom. But I remember going into grade 9 and 10. I was in year 9, and I had a teacher. And he noticed that, like, I guess I had potential. And when it came time to vote a school captain, and this was the biggest provincial high school at that time, Gero High School for the Papua New Guineans that are here. And if you're a very quiet person, it's a tough school to be in. And my father thought it was important to go to a public school and, you know, learn what it is to be tough and grow up. He gave me no choice and said, you know, you have to stand for our, you have to represent our class as our nominee for school captain elections. You know, just someone that believed in you. And though I said no and protested, I must have written something that was pretty nice, because the school gave me overwhelming votes to be school captain. And I tell that story because I think that's really what young people need, people that are able to look inside them and see their potential and encourage them, help them see things that they maybe can't see about themselves because they might be going through a tough situation, or they might not have had people that spoke well over them. And a lot of that stuck with me when I went into university, and I remember doing first, second year law, and seeing again just that discrepancy with what was on paper. We have great laws, we have great frameworks, you know, we've got, you know, for me, I think our national goals and directive principles give that, you know, framework of where PNG is and how it can be unique. But then when you look around you and you see that it's not being implemented, and people don't know, and I think there's a lot of ignorance. My course mates and I came together and said, you know, we have a lot of free time apart from studies, and we know a few things. Maybe we can go out there and, you know, give some community talks and educate people about, you know, the law. So we started doing a bit of that, and then some of our lecturers, you might know Dr. Kwa, sat us down and said, you guys are doing a really good thing. You guys shouldn't only limit it to law school. You should open it up and let students from other strands come in, because communities need to know a lot more than just their legal rights. So we sort of came together and said, actually, that's a good idea, but I don't think anyone will join us if we, you know, open it up. And it was called the Law Awareness Group. Like, no one would join us. So we began thinking of a name of what we could call ourselves. And I remember, again, thinking back to that grade 8 classroom where that voice, you know, would speak to me inside and talk to me about my potential and talk to me about what I could do. And I think that voice exists inside every person that encourages you to do more. So when we said, hey, we have to settle on a name, let's call ourselves The Voice. Because I think if people listen to that voice, our country would be a better place. I think the world would be a better place. And just as an idea going forward, we started as a student group. a lot of interest came in to support the organization. We decided to incorporate. I didn't think it would take over my life. I seriously thought I'd be a policy lawyer, but that hasn't happened yet. Hopefully it will very soon.
So what do you do now?
Yeah, so now The Voice runs, we'd say, a leadership program. We partner with universities and high schools, educational institutions, and put in place centers for leadership. So we have partnerships at the University of PNG, the University of PNG University of Technology, and recently the University of Goroka. We have centers for leadership that are set up in these universities, and we run a three-level leadership program with the students. So students come in their first year. We select 40 students. Had over 350 applications this year for the program. So we have a screening process. We get 40 students in each of these institutions, and then we run them through the three levels. Firstly, focused on the dream and self-discovery, personal development. At the second level, it's about active citizenship, and at the third level, it's about nation building, and getting them to understand the country's development plans and how they fit into it as a citizen. I think it's really exciting work, because I think when you begin to see like-minded people come together around values that have a vision and actually own the country's vision, I think there's a lot that this generation can.
How is it funded?
So a lot of questions, Sean. We're funded by, our core funder is Bread for the World. It's a German donor, and they give us the half of the program funding that we need to get this aboard. We also have very good corporate partners. ExxonMobil has funded most of our work at the University of Technology, so Exxon has been very good. And the rest we fundraise. We have a company limited by guarantee here in Australia called Friends of the Voice Australia, and we've run fundraising dinners here that have been hugely successful. And we've got a lot of very committed people that just believe in it a lot and give a lot to it. So.
Jeffrey's an artist. Can you explain to us, I found it very interesting, your description of how you shared the proceeds of some of your portrait work with the subjects.
Thank you, Sean. I've been painting for almost 12 years professionally, and I paint mostly portraits. I started out I never thought of myself as a portrait artist, and there was a competition to paint Queen Elizabeth, I think. And I was 19 at the time, and I did this portrait of her in a Simbu headdress. And it was very stunning red feathers, and just adorned quite beautifully, I thought. And this painting drew a lot of attention, and eventually it ended up in London, and she was able to view it. And it now sits at the PNG High Commission there in London. From that beginning, many, many people asking, can we have a portrait? And so the career began. Now, I initially thought the trend was at the time to paint and celebrate PNG's diverse traditional culture. So we were painting faces of painted faces. And I thought I'd step away from that and focus upon the Melanesian people, our people without the painted faces, and our people doing the ordinary things that they were doing, even when there wasn't a celebration going on. Focus on the everyday scenes of perhaps an informal market where they're selling betel nut on the side of the road, or in the marketplace, focus on marginalized communities and people. So oftentimes it was paintings of mothers struggling to earn school fees for their children, or a young laborer working for a company, or an unemployed youth smoking a cigarette. You know, these were my subjects, and for me it was very important to celebrate and to elevate these individuals. Now, there was a certain ethical dilemma for me, personally, when in doing so, I was also a professional artist, so I had to sell the work to make money. So every time I created the painting of an individual that was perhaps marginalized in society, I was also benefiting from the sale of the painting of that person. So in order to reconcile my own feeling inside, I thought that I would share the proceeds of the work with the subject so that they were fully aware of the process that I was going through, and to acknowledge that very in a traditional manner. There were times where I would host a little, as we would say, kaikai, just means an shared meal together that we would prepare, and during that, an opportunity gave me the opportunity to talk about my work and to share some of the proceeds. So this was just one way in which I overcame a hurdle where, in today's sort of capitalist society, where transactions are based, when doing such work, you can ask for a model and you pay the model a certain fee. And whereas I was going into the community itself and engaging with the people and trying to capture them doing what they were doing. And I think this is a dilemma for all photographers as well. Whether or not it's seen in the same manner, it's difficult to say. So that was generally the process that I went through. Now that has also birthed something else, where charitable organizations have been in contact with me to sell these works and to help raise funds for themselves. So there's emerged this partnership, a symbiotic partnership, where the charitable organization would auction off the work, and I would collect a certain percentage of that sale, and this has been very successful. In Papua New Guinea, charities do a lot of great work, very valuable, critical work, where the government is not paying attention toward. So in this way, as an individual, I'm able to give back to the wider community. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you. Alan, one of the great saving graces of PNG is subsistence agriculture. It feeds so many people, but PNG is facing a bit of a drought at the moment. How serious is this going to be, and what do you think should be done?
Well, I think it's going to be more serious than the last one. And the funny thing is, and I don't want to beg the government, but NARI and other research organizations in Papua New Guinea have been warning the government for at least the last 3 years that such an event was coming. And the fact that we're so unprepared for it, already there's reportedly deaths, people are starving. Whole crops have been wiped out, and if you when the last one happened, I was in Oktedi at the time, and Oktedi had to scale down. I was one of the employees that was left behind to sort of watch over the place, and I recall the jungles were burning, tropical jungles were on fire, villages. If you can imagine, thatched roof houses sort of built next to one another in clusters, and in that sort of dry environment, embers can be carried in the air, and so as soon as one house caught fire, you'd lose the whole the whole village would be without shelter. And there's certain areas in the country, places like Telefomin and Noksapmin, which don't have road access to the rest of the country, with significant populations. And the other thing also was that after the last drought, the Australian government actually funded a reseeding program. I chaired one of the programs under that, and in terms of going out and multiplying seeds through NARI and distributing it to the subsistence farmers.
NARI, the National Research.
The National
Institute.
Agriculture Research Institute. And I think that's the thing, because 85% of Papua New Guineans live in rural areas, essentially outside of government systems. So you're talking about 5 million people living outside of, government or, you know, what you might call modern connectivity and so on and so forth. So it's this significant group of the population that's actually classed as subsistence farmers. So essentially they grow their own food. Most of the time they may supplement it with whatever cash they earn from the surplus and buy stuff in shops and so on and so forth. So, and the other significant thing which I think Australians might be interested to know is that almost all Papua New Guinean crops that these subsistence farmers have access to cannot be stored, unlike grains which can be stored for years. Most of our crops have a shelf life, you know, as soon as you pull them out of the ground or harvest them from a tree, they have a shelf life of less than 5 days. And that supply has been decimated. So, and then you couple that with the fact that government did not make provisions in case such an event did occur. And that then gives you an idea of what could actually happen. And the other thing you have to bear in mind is that these people don't have access to piped water supplies. They would get their water from a well in the ground or a running stream. And that well has dried up and the running stream has dried up. So, you know, I mean, all this time, the way we farm, that's the other thing. If you look at farmers in Australia, you're used to difficult conditions, so you irrigate your crops and so on and so forth. We have a slash and burn agricultural system, so you just burn the bush, stick the seeds in, and you let God worry about the rest. Well, the guy that used to water the crops has actually turned the taps off. So it's while I jest, I think our people are, the predictions are, the last drought in 97 lasted about 6 months. This one, they're predicting, is going to last longer than 6 months, possibly up to 12 months. And this could be the worst drought we've seen ever. And given all of those circumstances, I think you have a significant humanitarian crisis occurring, you know, right on your doorstep, essentially.
Sean, can I also
Certainly.
Say? So I remember, just on the point you said about food storage and how the food does not, it's perishable. I read a lot of Jared Diamond's books, and in his book on Germs, Guns, and Steel, he talks about how civilizations have progressed, and just in line with the whole theme around 40 years, one of his major theses was that, you know, PNG, oldest agriculturalist, the same time as the Mesopotamians. I'm sure everyone that has an interest in PNG would know that. But he tries to study why PNG did not progress further. And that's actually one of his major theses. It just came down to the fact that our people were never found a way of actually, and no kinds of foods that were able to store themselves. So for the larger part, while other civilizations progressed, they managed to find ways in food like wheat that managed to get them past surviving.
And rice.
Exactly, and rice. So I look now really where we are at as a people as well. And I think, you know, even in our towns and cities, so much of life is really just revolved around trying to survive because life is really, really tough. And I think, you know, when I talk with my peers, one thing that seems to be coming out a lot is that, you know, we can't rely on our jobs to give us, you know, steady income to, when we can't, you know, the tap might stop on that as well, and then what will become of us? And I think a lot of them are becoming a lot more entrepreneurial, and they're thinking, how can I start a business? How can I have more than one income? And I think as a people, once we move past just trying to survive, that's when people will begin to get a bit more innovative. They won't try to take from the system continuously, but try to see how they can actually feed something back into the system and allow it to grow. So, yeah, anyway, I just thought of that one. Alan was saying.
Yeah, well, another one of the problems, of course, in PNG is domestic violence and problems. When I picked up the newspaper on the front lawn this morning in Brisbane, the front page is Darren Lockyer and the Premier of Queensland and seven other people forming a united front to try and convince Australians there should be less domestic violence, because there have been three domestic violence murders in Queensland in the last 3 days. But you're involved in that, aren't you, in PNG?
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little about it?
Sure. So I sit on the management committee for a newly formed non-governmental organization called Family PNG. It was actually started by a group of people that came up with the idea, who are ex-MSF, Doctors Without Borders, inlay the project that they had running with the Engau Hospital, the Family Support Center. And there was an evaluation done by someone by the name of Dr. Kamalini Lokuge, that is from the ANU, and they identified that one of the biggest problems they had with victims of family sexual violence was, apart from the medical care that was given to the women and children, mostly women and children, there wasn't enough support for the women to try and get the kind of outcomes that they want. We all know that family sexual violence is a huge, huge problem in PNG. One of my firmest beliefs is that we cannot, if the nation does not address that, we will not be able to move forward, because our people are completely broken. When you inflict violence on a person, you break their human spirit. They aren't able to think past, you know, themselves and their value. So it is a critical issue that has to be addressed. And one thing that we do now, we run through Family PNGs a case management center. So we get referrals from the police, from Engau, from the hospital, and other of our service partners, and we sit with the women and children. We go, what do you want? And for some of them, where the levels of violence are just too high, they're just, I just need to get away, but I don't have the means. So right now, the only solution that we've been able to offer that is long-lasting is repatriation, so back to the woman or the child's home and family. But we know that that is not a sustainable solution, and the only way I firmly believe that we will be able to address this issue is when really the justice mechanisms through the courts, through law enforcement, are able to really work. Because if you crack someone's skull, you can't address it through compensation. You have to have some kind of stronger punishment, punitive measures, sending people to jail. And as we see examples of successful cases where people do get prosecuted, and people know that if you do that, there is going to be a consequence for it, that won't involve just being able to silently between families exchange money and say it's sorted. I don't know if we're ever going to see
it. If I may, one of the one thing that sort of feeds you know, the violence that goes on is the fact that, And I like what you said, Sean, about, you know, I watched the news about how Australian police responded. They were really quick to apprehend, you know, the perpetrators. In Papua New Guinea, it takes a long time to identify the perpetrator and then apprehend the perpetrator and then have the perpetrator face justice. So I think our people are, the thing I say about Papua New Guineans is that It's like we have a knife in our side, and rather than pull the knife out and fix the wound, we're like, oh, look, she'll be right. Let's just, you know, manage this. You know, I can live with this. So we kind of work our way around difficult issues. So the community responds by paying compensation because it's an immediate restitution. That's what they do, or, you know, the husband's people or whoever, and they do that. And it's not right, but having to wait 3 or 4 years to get the justice through the legal system, I think, forces the people to find their own solutions. But at the same time, it's not really a good sanction, because if you know, like in Australia, the police are going to descend on you the minute you break the law, then that is a preventive measure in itself. But in a place like ours, where it takes so long for the, give you a terrible example. I'm chairman of my local hospital, and we had money stolen from, I'm chairman of the most rundown hospital in the country. And the money we set aside for maintenance was actually embezzled. I had to fly the fraud squad in from outside of the province, from Port Moresby, because we couldn't trust the police in the province. They did the investigation, they've got all the evidence, they arrested the people, and now we have to wait 3 years because there's 200 other cases that need to be dealt with by the legal system before this one gets to the front of the line. Now you can imagine what will happen to family violence and all of the others, because they're sitting in the same queue.
And the thing is that our current Attorney General is doing a lot of good work, Dr. Kali Noi, and one of his priorities is justice administration and actually making sure that the village courts are actually working and making sure that we build a capacity of our village courts and the district courts to handle these type of cases. And if people that are administering justice at that level don't really understand the law, then, you know, we're going to have problems, and we need to have judges out there in the provinces. But again, when we have so few, it's hard. But there is good work that is currently being done on that, and I absolutely agree as well. If people don't see justice being served, then they will resort to their own means. But we have to get the wheels of justice turning, and people have to go to jail.
Jeffrey, do you have any comment on this issue?
I think fundamentally, the issue of violence in itself being a form of communication, and if you looked at communication as a spectrum of expression, and perhaps at one end the extreme being assault and murder and what have you, there is place there for perhaps an alternative to bringing about change in an individual. And I think the key word here is individual. I think approaching this by looking at the individual, approaching this by looking not just at the, obviously laws all help, but fundamentally speaking, we have to be looking at the mindset and encouraging individuals to feel comfortable in their modes of expression and to understand that there is a spectrum of expression that goes beyond just expressing yourself violently. Now, in Australia, you have these spate of incidents. Certainly, they will continue to rise. Why do I say this? Because you have a system in place currently that is an effective justice system, yes. But unless you deal with the issue at an individual level, fundamentally, you won't change the issue.
Yeah, I agree with you completely.
Well, I mean, for us, I think, and I made the point yesterday, which, you know, I like to try to understand why people do the things they do. And I remember as a young man, I think like most civic young men, We have a few beers, and the first thing we want to do is fight. So that's how we express ourselves. I think my Highlands brothers are the same, but most Papua New Guinean men are like that. So I quit drinking shortly after I started because I realized it was... And that's another thing, the prevalence of alcohol and all of that adds to it. But I remember, because I run my own business, and I find in PNG, and I talk to a lot of other employers, and they will all say, Papua New Guinean women are the best workers. They're conscientious, they get the job done, the quality, you just can't fault them. And that makes a lot of sense to me, because culturally, if you go to a garden or you do any village activities, you find that the men, in terms of their role in the society, they do the heavy work. We cut the logs, for building the house. We chop down the sago palm, we pound it. The women will then wash the pit to get the sago out. But most of the time, the role of a man, certainly in my society, in Abalam society, is a bodyguard for the tribe or the family. So for millennia, the man's role has been that of a bodyguard. Doing other work was not his role. Prior to independence, you know, like less than 100 years ago, we had contact with Western society, and suddenly we're supposed to change our roles. So most Papua New Guinean men are only one or two generations away from the bodyguard, the village guard, the warrior. And I think when they're faced with situations where they can't have access to jobs or anything else, they fall back to their default programming, which is the warrior. And they have difficulty understanding that, because you have church, you have all these other things, but behind you there is this default programming that your father, your grandfather, and your great-grandfather, this is what they did, and you are required to behave differently. And I made this point yesterday, and I was watching National Geographic one time, and I was watching these army ants going through the Amazon jungle, and the narrator was describing them. And apparently all the female ants stayed in the nest with the queen, tending the young and storing the food and whatnot, while the big male ants were out hunting and killing large insects and bringing the food back. And I thought to myself, that's exactly like my village.
We could go on and on and on, but I would like to throw it open now to questions from the audience. Does anyone like to throw a question to any of our panelists here?
You spoke briefly about innovation and how sort of certain levels of certain development, strains of development are encouraging or, stimulating people to kind of become more innovative about income strands. And then you also talked about a potential serious humanitarian problem in the drought that is sort of occurring at the moment. Is there any innovative strategies or things that could be supported or ideas that people are having in order to kind of, manage the drought situation? Are there any solutions on the horizon that could be supported?
I think the thing that's already working is what we call the One Talk system. Those that are from a particular area, and again, this is the strength of being from a particular place, and this particular place, wherever it is in PNG, that is now meeting the full brunt of the El Nino, you'll find that people from that area in other parts of the country, certainly even around the world, they are putting together funds to supply food. I guess the reason why I was making that point is that the fundamental issues about food security are not there. So what you're seeing is, their ability to access wild food in terms of animals or wild plants, that is also being reduced dramatically. So it's a situation where for them to access food and even fresh water, it'll need to come from some other place. And this is where, in a situation like that, the innovation needs to have happened 12 months before, rather than right now, in my view anyway.
And I know my friend was telling me about, she's from Chimbu, and it is one of the provinces that is affected. When the community began gathering, I think it was just a week ago, and they said, you know, we have to do something about this. And they came together within a week, managed to spread the word out. They raised 35,000 kina over the weekend, just collecting money and donations from people. And they're starting to try and see how they can use that money, of course, to buy food and help the families that are affected. But I agree with what Alan is saying as well. The problem is how we're going to address this beforehand. But it is the strength of community, I think, that we have.
Could I have another question? Yes.
Good evening. I'd be interested in each of your thoughts on thinking about the next 40 years of Papua New Guinea and what you're most excited about, and maybe the flip side of what you're most worried about.
Maybe I'll go first. I think the biggest positive for Papua New Guinea is the fact that it sits within some major strategic assets in terms of strategic in the world sense. We take a look at fisheries. We within our territorial waters, we have 15% of the world's tuna, which at the moment we are not, in my view anyhow, extracting maximum value from for our people. We have certainly the most pristine river systems and some of the cleanest water on the planet that is currently just spilling straight into the ocean. So 10 years from now, when all of your water is polluted, I'm sure you don't have to look far to get your water. But you'll have to pay us something for it, I guess. In terms of our forestry, we have the third largest rainforest on the planet, which is probably burning right now. But within that, I think there's certainly value to be extracted. I don't even want to, everybody knows, and I've got my good friend from Exxon kind of looking at me, you know. Obviously, the oil and the gas assets are significant. And, you know, from some of the information going around, the projects being worked on right now are not the biggest ones. The biggest ones are still to come on stream, if they do come on stream. So in terms of money, there's going to be a lot of money within that area. But fundamentally for us, and that's why I think I'm more interested in why things are not happening the way they should. I'm not so worried about... in my training, I'm trained to look at the worst-case scenario, and if that's acceptable, you then proceed. That's my business training, essentially, thanks to BHP. But anyhow, there is not going to be any shortage of money, but I think our real shortage is in the area of human talent to use those resources in a way that suits us. You won't find too many Papua New Guineans buying shares and participating in those sorts of derivative financial things. Most Papua New Guineans are more interested in having a happy life. They're not, culturally, we are not about accumulating wealth for self. And certainly there's a small percentage of us that are now doing that. So whilst I think things are really positive, 6 years ago, there were no entrepreneurial training programs in Papua New Guinea. I can tell you that now. Today there's at least 50. So there's a real interest in developing entrepreneurship skills amongst Papua New Guineans. So I think that'll come to the fore, certainly within the next 10 years. How that then succeeds in the global environment still remains to be seen. But, you know, to summarize, we have key strategic assets. The challenge remains for us to determine, and that's the thing, you don't get too many countries on the planet. We still have 10% GDP growth, and we will continue to have 10% GDP growth for the next 30 years. It's translating that. So we have huge pluses. Scoring goals is a problem.
Sir Jeffrey?
To follow on from Alan Bird, I think it is about translating those minerals, those resources into cultural development, because cultural development is an unending source. It's renewable. It comes, it's innate to the human being. And I think the future is very exciting, because the future, it'll lead us more toward the expressions that we have, the output of the thoughts that we have. And I think if we can translate those minerals and those resources into creative thoughts, innovation, this is Papua New Guinea's future, I see. And it's a sustainable future. And and until we do this, until this turns over into, translates over into cultural development, I think we'll still be on the rat race wheel. We'll continually be plowing the ground, digging deeper and deeper for minerals, and there's no end in sight.
It's good.
Serena.
And I mean, we all know the challenges that exist. I think PNG's greatest asset is not in the ground, it's not the oil or the gas, it's actually the people. And I think if we as a nation invest into the things that actually matter, that are our people, I think we'll have a very bright future. I think one of the greatest things that we have received from our government is a vision. It's documented in Vision 2050. And recently there was a call for a paradigm shift through STARS. It's the Responsible Sustainable Development Strategy. And I think I'm excited as a young leader in the country, and the fact that we have a roadmap of what to follow. And I think that if we focus on those seven pillars and we work collectively towards owning that vision and finding our place within it, I think there's a lot of hope going forward. And I think the greatest challenge is if we don't strengthen the institutions that actually have to carry out that work at that ground level. So I talked a lot about, you know, that within the law and justice sector. If we have strong institutions that can outlive people, a lot of great people, but they aren't able to create the systems to outlive themselves. I would hope that this generation would be systems thinkers, so that they'd know how to build things and actually be able to pass on something to the next generation. And as a nation, we should see that the generation should get stronger. And I'm proud of our fathers, and I'm excited about the work we can do to try and continue to build a stronger PNG.
But, sorry, just one quick one. But having said that, I came to Sydney and, you know, I look at all the stone buildings and I can smell the pollution, because where I come from, I can't smell that. And so I'm thinking to myself, maybe 20 years from today, when you go to a doctor here, I mean, that's something that I think is coming, with emphysema or something, and the drugs can't cure you. Your GP will probably say, I'm prescribing this new medication for you. I'm sending you to WeWork for 3 months, and that will cure you. So I think that sort of thing is coming.
Another question.
Thank you very much. When I was working at the United Nations, I noticed that Papua New Guinea was playing a very important role. They really were punching above their weight, even when they were not chairpersons of the G77. Is there some idea of having, let's say, an international responsibility in Papua New Guinea, and do you want to in the future continue this role and try maybe play even a more important role in the group of 77 or in the United Nations altogether?
Certainly, I think you'll find, because we're Melanesian men, and, you know, we're very chauvinistic, you'll find that those sorts of things, which is, you know, beating your chest in public, and we get attracted to that a lot. So you'll find it's very attractive, and Our consul general is smiling. he understands, and all the Papua New Guinean guys are smiling at the back. If there's an opportunity, I think, for Papua New Guineans to participate in those sorts of events, you'll find that we're tearing down the door to get to it. And if they do come, the real question is how we acquit ourselves. That's what I worry about. When one of my good friends got appointed to run the World Coconut Institute, I remember sending him just one paragraph email saying, I thank God that they've appointed a Papua New Guinean who is not going to steal money, he's not going to sexually harass the women in the office, and I am proud of you.
Papua New Guinea is going to host APEC in the coming years, and they'll try and make the best of that, I think. Have you guys got any comments to add about how Papua New Guinea could play a bigger role, or Papua New Guineans could play a bigger role internationally?
I think we've got a lot domestically that we need to sort out, quite humbly speaking. And as I had mentioned earlier, you know, and I say it again, it's at an individual level where we need to correct a lot of things. And maybe a good example is like, if, for example, our Prime Minister, if he looked within himself to correct himself, his outward expressions would influence our entire nation and we could change overnight.
Yeah, I totally agree with Jeffrey as well. And for a long time within our own organization, even though we got a lot of invitations to go abroad and to speak and contribute, we sort of said, no, we have to prioritize, and our focus right now is working within the institutions that we're at. But this year, an opportunity came for us to nominate a young person to go and be part of the Sustainable Development Goals in the UN Youth Summit they had. And I was really happy we sent one of our first young people to participate in that. And being in the UN in New York was such a great experience for her. And I know she's really running with the flag on sustainable development and the work that we're also doing with Ellen and the team from Department of National Planning. So I think there is a lot of room for that, and once we get stuff sorted.
Thank you. Good night. Let me comment all the speakers and so on. 40 years from now, we have a challenge. Basically, our government has gone into free education and free health, and the capacity to enroll all our children, if you like. We used to fight about getting percentage of women into institutions and all those places. Now that's all gone. All the kids are being educated. So our challenge is to see how far we've gone. And maybe our baby boomers of the 60s will leave us soon. We need to dwell on what the young people are now talking in front and take on their ideas. And as a Melanesian, we don't listen to young people. We are stone heads. You know? we need to move on with the new ideas and innovative. And the challenges that happen is that PNG tried to show its status in the region. We just completed the PIFS of today. We hosted the Pacific Games and included Australia and New Zealand. We're hosting the ACP very soon, followed by APEC. So give us support, and we should be there. And we belong to one region. We Papua New Guinea always make comments that we are not going to depart with Australia or New Zealand. We are here to stay. Thank you.
Can I just ask the three panelists, Australian aid is becoming less and less important in PNG in terms of overall terms, but it's still $500 million a year. If you could give advice on the Australian aid program, what would it be?
Actually, it's the same advice I've given when I've been asked in the past. To me, I think it's really a strategic question. Where is the place where you would, if you could strategically invest to get the biggest outcome in terms of returns? And to me, that lies in the untapped 70% of our population, you know, those that are the subsistence farmers. Finding ways financing market chains. Like Australia gives us, what, $500 million a year. But Australian markets are closed to Papua New Guinean goods. It's open to Fiji, it's open to Tonga, Samoa, Vanuatu, but it's closed to us. The best way you could, for me, use that money to open up opportunities. Don't build roads. We've got enough roads. Don't build wharves. The government can do that. Do the things that the government can't do, which is empower the people and give them market access. Papua New Guineans don't need a handout. They need a hand up. And we're not getting the hand up. And the hand up is access to market. If you want a partner, strengthen the partner. And the partner is really the people. And if they can have access to, through the aid, if you need to fix up things like quarantine, if you need to fix up things like coal supply chains, whatever it may be, Australian consumers are looking for organic goods and you're paying through the nose for it. I was just at some of your supermarkets since I've been here. All our produce is organic and you don't need a certificate to prove it. But you guys can't get it. So I would find a way to get that here. And because you're directly empowering communities, going past government, these communities will then be able to get up and look after themselves. And I think that's what you want.
Jeffrey.
I totally agree with Alan there. We've got to look at building our people internally, giving them the options to grow for themselves. I think it's really important. As for myself, I come from an artistic background, so I think, again, culturally, it's really important that we assimilate values. And at the moment, I mean, we can have all the government systems and all the intellectual debates we like, but not until we share the same values and the same visions. I mean, and that's culturally. I mean, fundamentally, it's culturally. So we've got to think beyond, outside the box that contains us at the moment and look at actually assimilating and being friendly with one another, approaching one another, respecting one another. And those are very fundamental core human values. And anything that can highlight those values and that relationship is very important.
Serene.
And just agreeing with what our Consul General had to say, I absolutely agree as well. Like, the government has made the road for free education, but I think what we're seeing now is really, like, I think there's lack of funding within the higher education institutions. That's our universities. I think they get, what, 14 million kina. What I'd like to see is that PNG knowledge is retained within the country, and I'd like to see the build-up of our universities so that they can become, you know, world class, because Papua New Guinea has a lot to offer in terms of knowledge, and I see a lot of other people from other institutions and other countries that are experts on PNG. I would like to see more Papua New Guineans become experts and recognized experts of their own country.
I think we've come to the end. I'm getting the wind-up call from the front seat here. So thank you all very much for coming, and could you thank the three panellists? I think this has been fairly impressive.
Thanks very much, Sean, and thank you to all of you for participating both last night and tonight, and thank you again for agreeing to come so readily to Australia. You've done a fantastic job in explaining Papua New Guinea to our audience, and I think we all have a much better understanding of the future. Thanks to you. Can I also thank my colleagues Anna Kirk and Tara Pena, who've worked tirelessly to put these two events together last night and tonight. Really, I could not have done it without them, particularly Anna, who's just works day in, day out to manage our Australia Papua New Guinea Network website, social media account, and keeping track of all our friends in Papua New Guinea and making sure they get on planes to come to Australia for our events. So thank you very much. Please stay and join us for a drink and get to know some of our panellists. Thank you very much.